six at the front.
Yeah, so as Ian said, we work together under the alias Mother Tongue. Mother Tongue, we consider it to be a research-led curatorial project, which we formed in 2009 in response to individual periods of research that we had done in Northern Scandinavia and West Africa. The project has produced events, exhibitions and publications in partnership with organisations such as CCA Glasgow, the African Motion Film Festival, Konstnärs in Stockholm, and undertaken residencies with HIAP in Helsinki, the Nordic Africa Institute in Uppsala, and the Creative Lab at CCA Glasgow. All of our publications are currently held in the collection of DOCFA, the Documentation Centre for Visual Art in Milan. The project participated on the Curator Lab programme at Konstfack, an art school in Stockholm, between 2011 and 2012, and we're each currently undertaking practice-based PhDs. As we said, myself, the Perfect, and Jess at the Research Centre for Transnational Art, Identity, Nation at UAL, which is a mouthful every time. And we're currently, our forthcoming project is a group exhibition for our stills in Edinburgh, which will open on April the 18th, and that's titled A Thousand of Him Scattered. So the objective of our talk today was first and foremost to try and be of use to you in some way. So we're going to be spending a lot more time today on the earlier stages of our collaboration and of our project than we normally would. To try and outline for you the decisions that we took that led us to launch the project. And secondly, the dark discussion after this was by Carolyn is very much about visibility and invisibility and absence and presence and noise and silence and in a theoretical sense and in exhibition making. And so we wanted to transfer this theme for the dark discussion over into this talk by discussing firstly, projects that have taken place, but afterwards spending some time speaking about projects that we tried to make work or we tried to make happen and that never materialised for whatever reason. Partially because we also sit through ourselves quite a lot of events where people lay out these very neat chronologies of their practice. And I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then you would think that everything, you know, it's very rosy, and you know that's how it's going to be when you leave art school, and you'll just magically go from one project to the next. Whereas the reality system behind that is normally that there's a lot of rejection letters and unsuccessful applications. So we're going to speak for about 40 minutes, leaving 20 minutes for a discussion at the end, and so begin by going through the collaborative practice. And Jess will speak about two of our projects that happened. Then I will speak about some of the projects that didn't materialise, even though it's very painful to admit publicly. And then we're going to try and conclude a little bit with how we see our curatorial practice and comments on that. So as we said in the introduction, we began working together in 2009, and we met while we were both doing our undergraduate at Duncan of Jorgensen in Dundee in fine art. And so we had separately taken these, we both had grants to go and do research abroad, and Jessica went to Northern Scandinavia, an area known as Sápmi, where Sami and indigenous people live, and I went to Nigeria. And we came back and both of us continued that research, and that led into our dissertation on our undergrad. And for both of us, what we had found interesting in these regions, the issues that we were looking at were what we felt was also applicable in some way to Scottish culture and Scottish heritage. And but we also, that process of going away and coming back and doing further research and then writing about it and writing about artists' work led us to both realise that we wanted to pursue a curatorial practice as opposed to a studio practice. So our collaboration began after graduation, when Jessica was committee member at Generator Projects in Dundee, and I was doing the Master's of Contemporary Art Theory at Edinburgh College of Art. So we had this kind of the early stages. It was a lot of dialogue and sharing between the two of us these separate bodies of research that we had done separately. And then we began to undertake some very kind of small and very modest early projects. We conducted an interview with the Glasgow-based artist Graham Fagan. We made a research trip and presented at a conference in Iceland. And then we produced our first publication in February 2011. And our research interests at this time really fell at the intersection between contemporary art and issues of linguistic purity, post-colonialism, indigenousness, cultural amnesia, collective memory, which are still of interest to us, but things kind of develop and go off on tangents, and so, but yeah, still very much kind of at the core. Following this first publication, we began working towards an artist film and video programme titled Double Distance, which took place in Glasgow in August 2011. And at this time we also applied to the Curator Lab programme at CONSPAC, which we then started in the September. Curator Lab is an international self-directed curatorial course dedicated to the advancement of curatorial practices based on research in arts, crafts and design. And it's designed to offer time to conduct research and to explore new directions and ideas in order to develop artistic or theoretical work whilst linking academic studies to cultural projects. That's their words. So our motivation for applying was largely to, for the first time, take Mother Tongue on as full-time, because obviously before then, doing masters and just being a generator, you know, you have kind of limited time to work on projects. But we were also kind of interested in this challenge of picking it up from Scotland and then placing it in Stockholm for this year. Curator Lab for us was really a key point. It was a very difficult and busy year, but it allowed us to do a lot of things that would have been unlikely otherwise. So during our year on Curator Lab, selected projects included programming two discursive events for the gallery Constable C. And in that year, we also did the residency with HIAP in Helsinki. We produced a two-part artist film and video programme in collaboration with Africa and Ocean and CCA Glasgow. We made a contribution to the archive project, an exhibition, What We Have Done, What We're About to Do, that will be the focus of the DART event, largely. And we curated an exhibition, German Speak German, as part of the CCA Vanguard programme for emerging curators, also their words. We undertook some teaching work for a series of seminars produced by Maria Lind, and it was also part of the programme where you would make a lot of visits to exhibitions, and we were able to go to the biennales at Istanbul and Gothenburg, and then we went to the Triennale in Paris and documented it. They're all biennale done after that.
And the Swedish have so much funding. that's what the education system is like, trying to avoid mainly. So go to Sweden if you can. It's free as well.
Well, not to live there.
Yeah.
That's the fun. We'll get to that part. So we're going to discuss German Speak German in a little bit more detail. And then a more recent project from July last year, You Wanted in Times Square List, in collaboration with the artist Chris Holland.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pass over to Jess to talk to you guys about that.
Yeah, I'll start with German Speak German, which was the first or the second in a series of exhibitions we made looking at migration as subject matter. And this is the first installment. Tiffany mentioned Double Distance, the film screening, which focused on the oceanic context of migration. And when we were reading up research in this, we came across an abundance of writing looking at the movement outwards. So how the focus on migrants moving away from home and the conditions faced when arriving to a foreign country. So bearing this in mind, we thought we kind of had a responsibility to look at the inverse of that condition, which is a focus on the idea of home. So looking at the migrants who were either forced to stay or chose to stay at home. So, yeah, we thought about the reversal, and this led us to German Speak German, which you can see the poster for here, which was at the CCA Glasgow in 2012. And we were really, to begin with, looking at ideas of the border zone and increasing European notions of, or European anxiety towards notions of nationalism and ideas of racial purity, and specifically via the history and interpretations of home as a concept. So within their exhibition, we presented the work of four artists. So there was Libya and Oliver Olofsson, who are a duo based in Berlin. We had Jonna Confra, who's a prolific filmmaker, who also set up the Black Audio Film Collective in the 1980s. And Merrick Algun Ringberg, who's a young Turkish artist living in Sweden. And we've met her through the Curator Lab programme in Stockholm. So the works were accompanied by an essay series, and the essay was an attempt at stamping our sort of curatorial thesis as one part, and also gathering written perspectives from different geographies. So it wasn't just about our personal view of this condition, it was about gathering other people's as well. And that these essays were made freely available to the public. So the works we selected were intended to each in some way illustrate a notion or explore an idea connected to the wider thematic of the show. And like I said, each acknowledge a specific geographical condition. So Jonna Confra's film, Memazine, it's a 2010 film installation, but we showed it as a single sort of screen here, which the artist very kindly let us do because of the limitations of the gallery. This film splices images of a lone figure in the Arctic landscape with archival footage of Birmingham from the period of 1960 to 1981, so it documents a period of arrival of South Asian and Caribbean settlers and the subsequent waves of rioting induced by second generation anguish and frustration. And the film is considered to be extremely emotive, so that film kind of, I suppose in a way, it informed the more personal, the more human idea of movement. Merrick's work was important from the point of view of highlighting the race political discordances and the privileging of the West and the rest. So this work, her concise book of visa application forms, demonstrated the very different bureaucratic approaches that countries have. For example, the Nordic countries, the visa applications were that thick, and maybe West African, two pages. And then lastly,
do you want me to go down to
these? This is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the work of Libby and Oliver was really, really important in bringing the work out of the gallery. And it's something that the subject matter that we'd chosen to focus on necessitated. We needed to reach a kind of wider audience because, as you'll know, a gallery audience isn't exactly the widest demographic. We wanted to reach the public, and that's very much ingrained within Libya and Oliver's work. So we had previously seen this project, Your Country Doesn't Exist, and in dialogue with the artists, they were really keen to appropriate that for the Scottish context, specifically through language. So they translated Your Country Doesn't Exist into Scots Gaelic, which you can see at the top of the poster. And these posters were again made freely available, and they were also distributed in larger scale throughout the city of Glasgow. No explanation as to why. No explanation as to why, there was no sort of labelling, they were just put up as sort of almost like, you know, the subliminal messaging that used to be legal. Yeah, so alongside the posters, we also had a radio broadcast which was played, I think, 3 times a day on various local radio stations, and it was it read, "This is an announcement from Libby and Oliver. Your country doesn't exist. Your country doesn't exist." And that was really a comment on the sort of imagined community and sort of preconceived notions of nationalism. Maybe people would question that, but in our experience, a lot of people related it to the independence movement, which I think was quite inevitable at the time, so we got quite a lot of questions about that. That was our... That was German Speak German. I think maybe just to talk very, very quickly about the practicalities of the exhibition. As Tiffany said, this was part of CC Vanguard, Emergent Curators. We were given £500 and around 3 months from our acceptance to organise the exhibition from start to finish to the opening date. And although it doesn't look like a lot, it was really quite demanding in terms of time and money. And I think we pulled down a lot of favours, which is one really important aspect of launching a curatorial career.
What kind of favours those are?
Yeah, so to move on to the second project, we're going to talk about our collaboration with the Glasgow-based artist Craig Maholland, who also teaches at Glasgow School of Art. And he mainly, I mean, he shows a lot in Glasgow, but his career has predominantly been made over in Germany. He shows a lot over there. So this is a creative lab, but just before we go into creative lab, we're going to talk about the origins of creative lab, because as Tiff said, all these sort of exhibitions and works are part of a series. They sort of lead on from one another. So, yeah, this is the project that we've done, again with CC, focusing on Afrofuturism. And for those of you who aren't aware, Afrofuturism is an emergent literary and cultural aesthetic that's concerned with, or combines elements of science fiction, fantasy, Afrocentricity, magical realism, and is focused on non-Western cosmologies. So it's about critiquing present-day dilemmas of people of colour, but also to revise and interrogate and re-examine historical events of the past. So our programme for CCA was in partnership with the African Motion Film Festival 2012, and we had the work of the Black Audio Film Collective, John O'Connor's group, Neil Balifa, Sanford Biggers, which are the two images on screen here, Rico Gatson, a US artist, and the Autolith Group, London-based collective, and Philip Mallory Jones, who was one of the first, I think, maybe you can't call him the first, but he was definitely one of the first in America to start using video to critique notions of Afrofuturism.
And we showed the same work for the Afrofuturism project that we had actually shown in Double Distance, I guess in very different contexts, but it was nice to be able to come back to the work again after having some time.
So shortly after this project, we started to discuss the films with Craig, who was very interested in them, but for kind of different reasons than we were. His practice is mainly concerned with ideas of post-humanism and queer theory, futurism, technology, and cyborg. And so while our interest in Afrofuturism kind of stemmed from critical race relations, his stemmed from the more technologized queer theory aspect. So we decided that this was definitely a really interesting discussion that we could have. So we applied to Creative Lab, which is a research-focused residency, not production. So you're not expected to go in and produce something. You're just given a room and a month to kind of play around. Making it sound professional. So, yeah. In July 2013, we worked with Craig for 1 month at the CC, and it became very clear that we needed some sort of common ground, some sort of anchor. And this took the form of a novel by Samuel Delany called Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, which traces alternative histories from Times Square, New York, which was actually originally a site for pornographic cinema and a social sphere for gay culture, but it was swiftly eradicated by Giuliani, the New York mayor. And within Delany's two-part text, Times Square Red and Times Square Blue, he walks through Times Square sharing personal experiences, his own personal experiences and descriptions of his own sort of prolific encounters to be...
It's very explicit.
Yeah, it's basically a pornographic novel. And the second part is a theoretical summation of the first. So the first part is his experience, the second part is how he relates that to wider social theories about queer culture and the eradication of it. The cleanup, as they called it. So the Creative Lab sort of offered us a really new way to work, because originally it would be me and Tiffany, or Tiffany myself, researching something, thinking about it without artists, and then sort of then engaging with artists, but this was totally different. Craig was with us from the beginning and sort of informed the way that we worked. Which is kind of something that we are quite interested to continue. Personally, curatorial practice cannot sometimes feel like you're limited just by the term, which sort of denotes a very conventional exhibition context, and I think that's not the case anymore. I think it can mean a lot of different sorts of practices. So that's something within this project that we're quite aware of and want to try to keep at the forefront. Therefore, we're going to work with Craig as co-producers of a film, and that film work is going to be a 3D installation. And these are the initial stills that we came up with on the Creative Lab residency. And yeah. I think that's it for the Creative Lab. I think really I'm going to hand back over to Tiff, who's going to talk a little bit more about, less of the theory, more about the practical stuff.
So, as we previously outlined, what we wanted to spend maybe this next section to discussing some projects that didn't work out, and there are many. This part was really hard for us to prepare. It's pretty painful to remember something and to say publicly, so bear with us. So we thought we'd try and run through as many of these as possible. We're going to do that chronologically. But we have given some, we've made some individuals and organisations anonymous for their benefit more than ours. So funding for Curator Lab was a major obstacle for us, to say the least. So during the summer before going, we sent so many funding applications that we actually have no idea how many we sent in total. Maybe could be as many as 50. And some, well, most you never hear back from, some come back a no, and a disproportionately small number with a yes. Quite early on in our tenure at Curator Lab, we began discussions with the gallery for a project there that was going to explore the visual representations of interracial relationships in contemporary art. And while they were initially very enthusiastic, and we had some email correspondence and some meetings, they later began to ignore all of our email correspondence, and after a while we simply gave up. And then we later developed this proposal in an application for curatorial residency and exhibition at La Galerie Noisy-le-Sec in Paris, for which we were shortlisted and interviewed. And in the end, we were unsuccessful because there was a new director, and she said that the immediate demographic of the gallery was very mixed, and that it would be too political for her to take on as an early show, given the audience that she would expect to get in. But what made it even worse was that a year before, we had actually been shortlisted and interviewed with another proposal for the exact same gallery under a different director, so twice we were interviewed and shortlisted and didn't get it, so never applied to them again. We have made unsuccessful proposals to, and the list is, Apex Art in New York, Mocada Museum of Contemporary African Diaspora and Art, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, the Canadian Centre for Architecture Quebec, Dentfree Centre for Contemporary Art Copenhagen, Paisley Museum, a guest curator post at Mario in Shetland, a proposal for the Pen Paradox ebook, and we just this month were unsuccessful in a proposal to the Hayward Curatorial Programme.
That's why we're doing PhDs.
However, it is as soul destroying as that is, it is really important to try and see the benefits of these experiences. Developing and refining proposals, at least for us, is one of the most creative stages in the curatorial process, because there are, most of the time, there are no the practicalities didn't sit in yet. You have a completely free reign. Interview practice is always useful. It's a chance to be ambitious in your scope and ideas. It's a form of networking in that you get to discuss your work and ideas with people you might otherwise not have the opportunity to speak with. So we try and think of it as a process that's never entirely fruitless, and sometimes the answer does come back yes. So at other times there has been a willingness between ourselves and partner organisations to work on a project, but there's simply been a lack of funding. We were in talks for quite a long time with Kallio Kunstall in Helsinki about a project, but in the end it was we made some inquiries about funding and nothing was forthcoming, and the conversations just tailed off. And such conversations, they take up a lot of time. The process of exhibition making is quite a speculative thing. You spend so much time writing about, we will do this and this will happen, in a kind of completely speculative way. And so it's worth saying that by the time the Stills exhibition will open in April, it will have been 2 years since we first started those discussions with them about that show. And so we spoke about the project for a year before we signed a contract and received half the fee, and then we'll receive the other half of the fee when the exhibition opens. And so, I mean, obviously, as you all know, people need money to pay rent and to feed themselves. So when that's when you are working freelance and this is the way things kind of are, you always have this kind of sense of urgency or immediacy in terms of sustaining and funding your curatorial practice. If we were to start listing the number of projects that we did without taking a fee or using our fee in the end as part of the budget because the money just wasn't enough, we'd have another talk entirely. We have found in the past that working as curators collaboratively and then continuing to be in education means that we fell in between the cracks of a lot of funding criteria. And despite maybe notions of what curators may be, it's often easier to raise money for projects and for artist fees than it is to pay yourself anything. And funding bodies like Creative Scotland have very little that's designed specifically for curators. So, I mean, it's people talk about it quite openly that if you submit an application to Creative Scotland, you can set the curatorial fee at a certain level. Whereas if you were in somewhere where maybe the funding is a little bit better, in the Netherlands, your fee would be more representative of the hours that you might actually work. So it became a kind of in-joke the year also that we started doing the PhDs. that through the framework program that Ian mentioned, all of the other freelance curators that were on that project, everybody basically started a PhD in the same year, and it became this joke that PhDs are the new freelance, because this is the way that people are trying to sustain their practice because they have no other options. But then the ironic thing is that you then go into education and you're no longer eligible for anything from Creative Scotland because you're full-time education. So I guess that's kind of, that's the negative. That's the negative part. But maintaining a curatorial practice and doing it is challenging business, but it's by no means impossible. So hopefully on a more positive note, we wanted to conclude by attempting to position our curatorial practice in relation to wider discussions about what curatorial practice may be, what it could be, what it should be. And firstly, we wanted to acknowledge, as is perhaps already apparent, that we have really quite specific research interests, something that we hope is beneficial rather than confining. And when Caroline approached us to do this talk, one of the first things we felt we had to kind of outline a disclaimer is that we never really speak about our practice as such. We've only before this ever given one interview, and that we actually focused on our practice rather than maybe the amount of time on the show, for example. And the reason being is largely because our curatorial projects are not primarily about curating. We like to try and see them as interdisciplinary bodies of research where writing is also always an outcome. The exhibition is about working through an area of research in a collaborative manner with artists to produce an exhibition that we hope expresses that process in a manner that's more compelling in every sense than if we'd simply written about it. And it allows us to experience the aesthetics of a work in a way that you don't get to unless you work with it and become familiar with it in a way that an exhibition in Stalin Diesel kind of necessitates. You become so used to having these objects around you that maybe you perhaps, not that they become less special, but you can walk past them really quickly and not feel bad, and I guess you get to touch things sometimes that because people, they give objects a really wide berth in exhibitions. You know, people will kind of go like this far, and you know, when you're installing and de-installing, you get used to things being, you know, close to you, and you see films so many times on loop that you know them inside out. So we don't think that there's really anything unusual about our methodology, hence why we don't really openly discuss it. The projects are not about us. We understand where our interests originate from and how they've been shaped by personal experiences. And the PhD, it's perhaps easier to tease out where we stop and where the research begins and vice versa. But we can, of course, never be invisible, as we'll be speaking about in Caroline's event later on. But we're always embedded in the projects in different ways. Whether or not it's kind of immediately obvious, we work in series, although we don't describe them as such, but always past projects are referenced in the next. They are each building blocks upon one another. And so for us, it's about creating a momentum in a specific subject area, projects evolving from one to the next in order to create a substantial contribution in both academic and curatorial terms that is a true synthesis between both forms. So we have brought some publications and posters at the front for your reference, and we'd like to thank you for your time and for listening, and we welcome any questions or comments. We're an open book, ask us anything.
Any questions?
It's really refreshing to hear you talking quite candidly about the, you know, the projects that didn't happen and the applications that dropped through the gaps. I'm just interested to hear a bit more about what you learned from that. Did you learn anything about writing applications more effectively? Or paths you just wouldn't go down, or being more selective?
You start.
There's one thing that we both are quite aware of when handing in an application that I think is never broached professionally, and that's the theft of intellectual property. Unfortunately, I think when you hand in an application, you're laying bare your ideas, and it's very possible that whoever's reviewing that could like the idea or aspects of it and use it in another way, or, you know, proposals are seen as a very, you know, there's not much discussion around them, but actually they're very personal things. So I think being strategic about what you apply with, we think about that a lot now, whereas before it would have been complete trust in the institution, and now it's like, okay, I'm going to question where this is going and who it's going to. So knowing who you're applying to, knowing, you know, their programme and being aware
that does also happen with PhDs as well. Now
yeah.
and then, you know, you hear of really bad things where somebody was researching something and writing something, and then their supervisor comes up with an interesting paper on.
It happens first.
I would like to think not so often. I think, I don't know, I feel maybe it's just a kind of a false sense of security, but when we're on kind of home turf, I feel a little bit more at ease about those kind of things. And
yeah.
when we're in London.
Yeah, the second thing is that I think by going out to Sweden, we learn very quickly that there's an ethical, there's maybe more of an emphasis on transparency within the Nordic countries that we don't have here. So when you hand in your application, you're well within your right to hand in an application to anywhere, regardless of whether they have an open call, regardless of whether they're advertising anything. You can hand something in, even if it's a commercial gallery, and you can expect an answer, you can demand an answer from them, and you can know how much funding they have and things like that. We were talking about this to Caroline earlier. It's something that people maybe in Scotland feel that they're less able to approach. And I think that's a real shame, because it stunts artists and curators, and it keeps people in power, which is something that I think we have to challenge and be troublemakers. You know, if you don't get an application accepted, ask why. You know, it's your right, it's public funding that most of them have. They have a responsibility. So I think with regards to, you know, thinking about who you're applying to, that would be what I would suggest. Otherwise, like Tiffany said, it's just a really, you don't realise your ideas until you get them out on paper. They almost are sort of predetermined. So I think writing as many applications as possible, as horrible as it is, nobody likes it.
And to always be, I mean, although a lot of people said no to us, we have never really kind of held back in who we apply to, and maybe even if we think probably outwith, maybe that's not an early, but give it a shot anyway.
It sometimes works. Curator Lab, like we really didn't think we'd have a chance in hell with that, and we got in. And we got in on a whim, like seriously. We were very lucky in that we had a really great director, a very rare director who's seen potential rather than evidence. And I think every now and then you will get somebody who sees the potential in you. So the wider you can distribute, the better.
We were the first Scottish people on that project, and then the year after us, Ben Fallon was on it, and this year Jenny Richards, that used to be a collector, was on it. So
you like Scottish people now.
Yeah, so that's something that we're kind of happy about.
Yeah.
That kind of has,
links.
That's our legacy. Curator Lab, more Scottish people.
Just wanted to come in as well to follow on from that question about switch it around. You're now curators. I once interviewed a series of great curators back in the 90s in the MFA, and very much around this question around power, how they're selected as a younger artist then. And the impression I got, or the clarity I got on that, was that actually they just really didn't need people to approach them. Their curatorial practice is exactly as you described yours today, in that you have a curatorial kind of theory and interest, and you're pursuing that as interdisciplinary research in a really interesting way, you know, fascinated. But you know the artist, and you find the artist that you want to work with in your research. And I'd say that's the traditional kind of view of curators, and it's the sort of the one that you're describing. So flipping that now, your curators, are you letting that experience that John has kind of mentioned influence your position then, and people applying to you, or how you connect with the artists that you've curated?
Well, I mean, I think the kind of major difference maybe in what we were speaking about is applying to institutions and curators who are based in an institution and their practice is situated there, as opposed to ourselves who have made a decision to remain out with that. So, I mean, we've never made an open call for anything, for many reasons. The first of all, we've never had the opportunity for an exhibition. I mean, CC, the German Speak German show, the time scale was so tight, like if you made an open call, like we would never have the time. I mean, it was £500, and then so rather we had artists who we had met, and then we used that 3 months to make funding applications to gain extra money so we could actually do something. Sorry, do you want to say something?
Maybe my question is about how you're thinking about yourselves.
Yeah.
In going forward,
I mean, two things came to mind when you were speaking, and that was our relationship with artists and the conventional method that you said where we select. I think that like we tried to emphasise, we don't follow like a rigid methodology for each project. Each project's very different, and what we really enjoyed about the Creative Lab was the fact that we're making it in dialogue with the artist, and we only became interested in the artist's work. It wasn't through seeing other show. I mean, yeah, we'd seen some exhibitions of his, but it was more the, it wasn't a, because the hierarchy is something that you're quite aware of being a curator, and there's also, let's be honest, quite a taboo about curators, you know, asserting a thesis over an artist's work. And that's something that we really are very aware of, and we don't really want to do. We would much rather make works in partnership, which we have done with Libby and Oliver, with Craig and with Merrick. You know, I think it's more about, I mean, I hate this word, but I think it's more about networks. It's about encountering work through various different
avenues. As a whole, it would be a, like there are quite a few people who we've returned to, like Graham, we interviewed him and then he let us show work in Double Distance, and then we went back to him with the What We Have Done project. But I think also in kind of very pragmatic terms, if you approach an artist to be in your exhibition, it would be very difficult to kind of say, you know, I mean, one of the things that we talked about is you always curate people's work that you like. You can try, but it would be quite hard to curate somebody's work that you didn't like, for personal reasons, like, I'd like to invite you to participate in this exhibition. I don't actually like your work, but I think it'll add something interesting. Like, I mean, if you were an artist and you received that email, like, would you say yes? But I think also something that we encountered is it could actually be completely possible to curate an exhibition of Artist Moving Image dealing only with distribution agencies and not even getting to the artists. Or also you could curate a show exclusively dealing with galleries and never actually even speak to the artist. And I mean, those distribution agencies, they have like set fees and everything works and, you know, what's the catalogue number for the work that you want to show. And then, you know, we can send it to you on the tape. Like, and that's also not... So, I mean, there are kind of practical elements, but I think...
But we do consciously, within each exhibition, try and address the emergent with established, because it's our responsibility as well.
And also gender, too.
Gender. Gender is...
With German Speak German, there was like a gender balance, but with Afrofuturism,
It was male.
I have no idea properly when you say tutorial practice. I don't know how to pronounce it. Tutorial practice. What does that mean, essentially? Like, to me, it means opening a pop-up gallery and then getting people to come in. And then, like, what does that mean? Can you clarify?
Well, I mean,
that's one of the problems.
What are you going to say?
Okay.
I think, I mean, this is something that on the master's program, people will debate all day long. the term curator originally comes from the museum and is more like a keeper of objects. So there is this kind of idea that you're caring for objects that you have in your store, maybe that you brought in. So that's where the word has kind of transformed, and there's been people keep on talking about how it's not really in the dictionary, like a lot of the, you know, curatorial. I don't think it's even in the dictionary yet. So, but obviously this term has been kind of transformed from the kind of museum objects context into contemporary art. I mean, a lot of people don't like it. For a while, facilitator went around for a while, where like you facilitated artists to do their project.
I think like the simple answer is organisation of artworks of varying mediums in a within a context. So a curator will, maybe I'm being, within, I mean, you can only really talk about your own practice. I don't know about other curators, but I know that in the the traditional sense, it's about having a premise or an idea, setting a context, and then organising works in order to inform that. So, a sort of illustration, if you will, of an idea.
But I mean, it's quite new. I mean, this kind of idea of the group. I mean, you probably go to a lot of exhibitions and group shows, and that's kind of something that really just came into being from like the 1980s onwards. Before then, you know, the big solo shows and the retrospectives and the group shows kind of more, quite a recent thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's as much as we would like to think that there's something creative there, there's also, as we said, a lot of funding applications, which I don't find very creative or stimulating in any way. A lot of admin. Sorting out works coming through customs, insurance quotes, dealing with printing companies. I mean, a lot of not so fun things.
For the German Speak German, you put up posters. Did you have permission to put up the posters?
Well, that was a big. We spent months in dialogue with Glasgow City Council, and because
months
they were
in Helsinki, in dialogue with Glasgow City Council,
because they were deemed political. They weren't allowed just to be put freely up because there's a ban on postering,
fly
postering. So we eventually, luckily my mum knows a guy who puts up posters for a living, and he distributed them for us.
At like
so there were
bare minimum.
So
that's
power for you.
My mum has dodgy pals, basically.
No, but it was completely like, I mean, this is the thing, like, the CCA would not let us do anything that would possibly err on the wrong side of the law and that could possibly land them with a fine. But, like, Libby and Oliver were really, like, militant and were like, no, you know, at first they said yes, and, you know, we've been thinking about that, and actually that's not quite good enough. Like, we need more, they wanted more informal.
Basically,
distribution of the, I mean, the process of the posters going up was ongoing. There were like a lot that were in like pubs and bars and in people's windows and more informal places.
Yeah.
mean, the last place that project had been before it came to ours was the Venice Biennale, so like you're going from a big massive budget to a really small amount, and we did what we could do, and I think that they were happy with it and they really loved the Gaelic, the radio broadcast. But yeah, it was very, working outside the gallery poses a whole new set of challenges, and it was tough.
So how did you decide on your name?
She said Hugo. I always get this question. Basically, like when Tiffany was describing the origins of the project, so Tiffany was in West Africa and I was in the Arctic region. We were writing thesis for our undergraduate. When we came back, we didn't really know each other at that point. We had the same advisor, dissertation advisor, who said, "You've written the same thesis, but about completely, seemingly polar opposite regions." So we swapped thesis and theses, whatever, and we reread them, and there was a sort of emphasis on language, and the notion of translation, and so
it just came up.
It just
really
came about.
Like, we kind of decided that we didn't want to use our names. I guess we wanted to hide behind something. And it was just kind of like, it was just suggested, like, mother tongue, and we were like,
yeah.
So, I don't know, we're quite kind of
like to be anonymous in the process. I suppose, because to be quite fair, like, the project that we're going to talk to Caroline about is about critiquing the Glasgow Miracle as a sort of capitalist, well, we won't say too much now, but basically we have quite strong ideas about that, and it really helps to, if you have quite staunch political views about something, it's not that you're hiding behind, but having a name allows you to maybe be a little bit more active, and allows you, when you're working with someone else, to maybe say things that you'd be a bit scared to say otherwise. So that's kind of why we use the name and where the name came from.
We have talked a lot about after the PhDs that we would like to try and have our own gallery space, because it's a different set of challenges. And we talked about, like, we wouldn't want to use the same name. Like, I don't know, maybe there will come a time when we just close the chapter and then move on to something else. This doesn't have to be forever, ever. But it fitted at the time, and just now we're going with it. And
yeah, change is good.
Would that be a commercial gallery or a public gallery?
I mean, I don't know. Because I think, I mean, personally, like, I ran Generator with some people for a few years, and it's just mighty difficult in the circumstances. Yeah, like
I mean, so far we can't even agree on where it would be. So I guess that's kind of like how.
Yeah.
I mean, you have ideas about what you want to do.
There are
features of it,
maybe not fitting into the category of commercial, and not fitting into the category of not for profit, but some sort of structure. I mean, ideally you would be working within a government supported gallery, like public funding. That would be great. But I don't know if that will exist.
Yeah, it's really hard to know. Like, I mean, I think maybe like most people, obviously the funding cuts don't seem to have hit as much in Scotland yet as they have down south. I don't think so. But then you don't really know whether that's just until the referendum's out of the way, because obviously you want to sustain some of that Scottish culture that's going to make everyone vote yes. And then, I don't know, afterwards, they're just going to be like, okay, well, that's... I mean, obviously, there's a Commonwealth too this year. So maybe after that, is that going to go too? So you really don't know, but I think it's something for the long term. It would just be nice not to have to make proposals to anyone. Just to have your space, and then you can do what you want, and...
you can surprise people because you didn't make a proposal, and then everyone, it's all, everything's out the bag. So yeah, we'll see.
Is that everybody's questions? Sort of wind up this part, first of all. So let's thank Tiffany and Jessica again. So we break a bit. And if people want to stay for the seminar, it's great to go back to your students. Question that curatorial practice thing again.
Can I ask, are most people